You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works Volume 75 by Rudolf Steiner. I'm calling them 11 lectures. They're lectures and discussions mixed together, titled Anthroposophy and the Natural Sciences, translated by Sabine Seiler. This is Lecture 5, which is a disputation evening on natural scientific questions, given in Zurich on June 4th, 1921. Jakob Hugentobler opens the disputation evening. A student. A young enthusiastic man would like to study astronomy. He wants to find out what Kepler, Newton, and all the others up to Einstein have come up with. He wants to have a clear picture of what is going on in that field. This person wants to enter into things objectively. He is directed to the field of mathematics, and either must take the trouble of entering into the very complicated states of consciousness of higher mathematics, in order to penetrate what scholars such as Gauss and Bayer have produced, or he must stop halfway. Someone in our time can have worked his way through everything. He can have read Plato, Feuerbach, Averroes, for example, and yet still lack certain dispositions of soul that could make a certain knowledge accessible to him. Thus he will have to admit that he has not yet learned anything about those spiritual worlds that anthroposophy talks about. If he is then told that he must prepare himself in a certain way, he is either motivated or not, as from epistemological and purely psychological standpoints, many different variations and regularities of life are possible. Now, this person thinks he has no right to doubt this or that. He does not mean to offend anyone present. But an aesthetic outlook on life is hardly suited for the perception of something essential. One has to struggle through hardships, and so on, is much closer to the entire movement than those who take up these things merely to pass the time, because they have nothing else to do. Rudolf Steiner. I would like to comment on what the previous speaker has said. It has been emphasized just now, and rightly so, that hardship and suffering indeed mark the path that is to lead into the world characterized by anthroposophy. Now I want to begin by taking up that last comment. In the course of my lectures, I have often made a similar comment, but always, I'd like to point out, based on some particular context. That is, I have often said that we human beings live our lives alternating between joy and pleasure on the one hand, and pain, suffering, and hardship on the other. With all due humility, if we believe that we have achieved a certain higher knowledge, then we still always have to admit that we highlight, perhaps for a very understandable reason, with too broad a brushstroke, what we have experienced of joy and pleasure in life, and for which we are, of course, grateful to the powers of the world. But we do not owe our knowledge to this. We owe our knowledge, actually, only to the sum of pain we have undergone. Thus, when we speak of knowledge in the true sense of the word, it is indeed something that originates from the sum of pain. But in our outer life, we can, in fact, undergo the most diverse pains and hardships. Hardships that depress us, and that can at times take away our soul's breath, so to speak. Still, there are also true worldview pains, that is, pains that, I want to say without meaning to hurt anyone's feelings, a large part of humanity does not know much about. The experiences we can have on the path to knowledge are such that they can, at times, take more away than the breath of our soul. And indeed, it was not for nothing that in ages past, and I want to call those people by the name they themselves used, the ancient initiates, the ancient sages, were trained on paths that we can no longer tread. Back then, they were indeed guided through pain and suffering, because that was needed to prepare them properly for knowledge. In fact, the hopelessness that assails those who tread the path of knowledge leads to pain and hardship that people can perhaps, with a measure of indifference, handle within themselves. Nevertheless, it is then still necessary that people take their place in life in the way the times demand. In the past few years, I have already emphasized in lectures here in Zurich that the suffering of the times, the hardships of the times, are ultimately connected with what people in recent times have omitted to do in the realm of knowledge. The knowledge that has celebrated the greatest victories recently, and from which all manner of technology already has and can still develop, this knowledge, as far as it insists on limiting itself to the realm of necessities and does not approach the realm of freedom, of which I spoke in general outline, is not suited to generate social thinking. That is the great task of our times that we are faced with. We must become able not only to think about nature, which by virtue of its solid structure of necessities guides our thinking about it, but we must also develop the ability to think free thoughts, which have strength because they once again submerge themselves in necessities. For without such free thoughts, our modern civilization will embark upon its decline. We cannot find social ideas if our epistemological foundation is nothing more than what we have in our modern times. It is indeed true that we enter into certain complicated developments of consciousness when we follow the naturalistic strivings of Kepler, Galileo, Copernicus, Newton, on to Einstein. But we must not forget that through all of this, only one-sided paths are opened for us. Even though Gauss, for example, already pushed the mathematical beyond the realm of mathematics. In all of this, we do not find those indications pointing us to ideas that can address social hardships. The same is true for the epistemological positions advanced by the likes of Descartes, Antomach, and Avenarius. There is still a completely different way that is opened up for us through what anthroposophical spiritual science wants. And indeed, the latter is closely connected with what is significant as precisely the sort of knowledge that has recently celebrated great victories in the natural sciences, and that, as I have tried to show today, flows into what the anthroposophical research and view is. What the esteemed previous speaker said about the aesthetic worldview is correct, but perhaps we should consider the term, quote, aesthetic worldview, close quote, more historically. When we look at the thinking that has developed out of the efforts of the natural sciences, then we have to say that it does not sink any roots into the social necessities, that it does not penetrate to the spiritual foundations of existence. This has resulted in a certain mood that has gone extraordinarily deep, especially in the last third of the 19th century and the first decades of the 20th century. Those who have observed how people have begun to be interested in certain higher questions could see people in the widest circles have begun to be interested in higher questions. I just want to point out how very widespread the discussions were that followed Bjornson's title, Beyond Our Power, for example. And I could mention many more examples like this. Thus we can say that a certain interest in the suprasensory world began to take hold, especially in this era. But how? People liked it best to accept things when they were presented in aesthetic form, one could say. That is, people preferred to accept knowledge when they did not have to engage their own capacity for knowing, if I may put it thus, but could receive knowledge as they do in drama or novellas. This means that they could convince themselves that they can get involved in something with their fantasy, just for once. But they did not feel compelled to reconcile things with reality. Indeed, people were glad that they did not have to reconcile anything with reality. Instead, they had a certain desire for sensation, indeed a rather extensive one. This sensationalism developed in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but people did not want such things to be in any way related to real life. This fleeing from real life has gained more and more ground. This non-connection and not taking entirely seriously the very thing in which one is actually interested, but regarding which one has only a certain hunger for the sensational. This is the very thing that must be taken away from humanity if civilization is to continue. And if we do not want to end up in conditions such as described by Oswald Spengler in his title Decline of Western Civilization, this must happen. Ultimately, it is only a fleeing from the painful aspects of existence, in a certain sense, a flouting of the painful aspect of existence. Clearly, what has emerged in the last third of the 19th century in Friedrich Nietzsche is a tragic phenomenon, as I would like to call it. We do not even have to look closely at what Friedrich Nietzsche said or what his significance is. We need only look at his life. Ladies and gentlemen, just think of the suffering that this soul underwent in three sequential developmental phases, and then connect that with contemporary history as a whole. You see, Nietzsche grew up leading a true philologist's life. But unlike other philologists, he did not devote himself to philology out of an outer sense of duty. Rather, he felt the constricting nature of the philological method early on. And out of this sense of constriction, he then chose what flowered initially in the 1860s, and then from the early 1870s until well into that decade in the circles in which Nietzsche lived. He lived into what had originated with Schopenhauer, and what in broad circles in society back then was nothing more than pessimistic talk. Talk about the misery in order to dull, to some extent, one's perception of the mystery of life. And Nietzsche suffered from all of this. And it was actually only a yearning to inwardly overcome the unidealistic mood of the times with a certain kind of knowledge. But around the year 1866, Nietzsche suffered from what was back then direct scholarly education. He wanted to set something against this scholarly education in his book titled The Birth of Tragedy and his title Untimely Meditations. These works were written out of deep pain. But by about 1876, Nietzsche had reached the point where he had to admit that this, too, was merely a covering up, and that he had to go deeper into human nature. And at that point, he had to realize also that human beings actually indulge in many thoughts, in much that is untruthful. And then he wanted to overcome this untruthfulness, first of all, through knowledge. After all, people have preserved ideals for themselves from the ancient past. In the early days of his work, Nietzsche also still believed in these ideals, but ultimately he saw the instincts behind the ideals. And that is what made him write something like title Human, All Too Human. There was then a second form of the development of the times from which Nietzsche suffered, only to finally arrive at the third form, where he endured the deepest suffering in his soul and felt the emergence of the human out of subordinate natural beings as a burden weighing on his soul. Because he was unable to advance to the spirit, the problem continued to face him. Human beings are only a transition from worms to the superhuman, Übermensch. And that is why Nietzsche, in his book titled Thus Spoke Zarathustra, could express this soul path of human beings only lyrically in his grand conception of the eternal recurrence, in which he could only get a glimpse from afar of what anthroposophy is to advocate, the repeated earthly lives and also the sequential metamorphoses of the world system. Nietzsche was the person who suffered most deeply from the education of modern times and who is broken by that modern education. Doubtlessly, at least for me there is no doubt, Nietzsche has provided the proof that the body can be broken by the soul. For it is in any case significant that a famous psychiatrist could say about Nietzsche's illness only that it was an atypical case of paralysis. And the yarns that have since been spun about Nietzsche's illness on the basis of the usual schemas of medicine, well, for people who can really see what was suffered there, what was suffered in the tension of striving to come to a comprehension of the supranatural, for people who look at this objectively, there's no doubt that this tension could break the body. I'd like to say that it can be seen directly how this organism was destroyed in a process that started in the soul, and the external symptoms are also in line with that. Just think of that tragic situation that had developed there. Let me describe it to you. Together with Paul Deussen, who later studied ancient India and philosophy, Nietzsche was a pupil at the secondary school, Gymnasium, in Schulpforta in Thuringia, and the two were good friends. In the 1890s, when Nietzsche was already quite ill, Deussen went to visit him, and as he stood before his friend and talked with him, Nietzsche did not engage in the conversation. Then Deussen spoke of their past, about this and that event from the past. And to this Nietzsche replied, "You know, regarding all this, I can tell you that a man was involved in this whom you do not know at all, namely my good friend, dear old Deussen, took part in those events." That is what Nietzsche said to Deussen, who was actually standing there in front of him. What Nietzsche had experienced in his youth was still present to him, but what was going on in his surroundings, in the immediate present, was extinguished. I mention this one scene, there are many more I could add, in order to point something out to you. What was expressed in Nietzsche's pathology could already be detected much earlier in his life. For example, 20 years ago I wrote a treatise entitled, quote, "The Psychopathological Element in Nietzsche's Work," close quote. And there I examined even his earliest writings, which are brilliant and magnificent, but in which one can already detect the dissociation of ideas. Those were ideas that grew entirely out of the fragmenting effect the culture of the time had on those who, out of the center of the human being, wanted to reconcile that culture with the suprasensory realm. And we can say that we see particularly in people who are shattered on the rocks of this culture, and this is what Nietzsche's real problem was, what struggle, inner struggle with inner hardship and suffering really is. Actually, the path to knowledge lies in overcoming such suffering. This path was already difficult to tread in the old days, because the aesthetic worldview, which although it is very much and fully justified in its own realm, nevertheless insists on not taking seriously the reality of that for which it has a certain sense, a certain sensationalism. That aesthetic worldview was so widespread in the time when people were fully prepared to work their way from Newton to Einstein, from Descartes to Mach or Avenarius. But for our time it has now become necessary that we work our way to something else, and that is what the path of anthroposophy offers. Namely, to something that can be arrived at by everyone. People claim that not everyone can make their way on this path, but we have to take that with a grain of salt. After all, not everyone can make their way into higher mathematics either. And I believe that anyone who not only makes his or her way into higher mathematics, but also to a certain inner understanding of the transition from ordinary geometry and mathematics to synthetic geometry, for example, is also, where his soul situation is concerned, well on the way toward imaginative cognition. We must find our way there, much as we also must find our way into the theory of functions. Of course, we could proceed faster on this path if the prejudices of the times were not always working so much against our progress. For instance, the belief that one needs very special talents and capacities of the spirit in order to advance in anthroposophy is much more widespread than it deserves. After all, the truth is that every person can advance along this path just as much and as well as he or she can make headway on the other scientific path. And I want to emphasize the following, because it is absolutely true. Hardships and misery lead human beings to the portal of knowledge. But what matters is that they find they're not just a certain inner mood, as I'd like to put it, but rather the real spiritual world. Only by knowing this real spiritual world will we become capable of bringing to the social aspect of material life what is needed so much in our time. Provided that we are met with understanding, because that is important above all. That is why, on the one hand, we must have understanding for the meaning of pain and suffering, and on the other hand, we must gain understanding for the concrete application of spiritual knowledge. Ladies and gentlemen, we have had enough of the general talk about something spiritual in the pantheistic sense. Really, that does not get us anywhere. People who talk only in general terms of a spiritual world and want to give it an epistemological basis are much like those who walk across a meadow and say that they don't care if others point out that this here is an autumn crocus, that over there is a lily, and there's a tulip beyond that, and so on. None of that interests them, because as far as they are concerned, it is all uniformly life. All they see are plants. Likewise, people whose thinking tends toward pantheism always want to exclaim, "Spirit, spirit, spirit." We can be satisfied that, at any rate, the spirit is acknowledged. People can satisfy a certain inner sensuality with this pantheism, with what I call, in quotes, modern mysticism. However, what the world needs today is concrete knowledge about the suprasensory worlds, and that is precisely what anthroposophy is most often resented for, even today. Namely, that it strives to attain this concrete knowledge. And for that reason, some people try to vilify it as being much like the movements of mysticism. Those who want to look at anthroposophy more closely will soon see that it really follows paths, albeit ones that we must first open up for ourselves, that allow it to give an account of itself to even the most rigorous sciences. That is what I wanted to say in connection with the very interesting comments of the previous speaker. Another speaker speaks. When I first heard about spiritual science, I took it serious in its entirety, I would say. In the lecture today, I had the feeling that I was hearing a scientific lecture. Such a scientific lecture could have been attended by scientists. But what if I am a painter or musician and must work productively in my field? The lecture could have been attended by someone who wants to attain knowledge of the natural sciences in the higher scientific sense. My question now is, shouldn't anthroposophy be understood in a much wider, more comprehensive sense? And I would also like to know how we should relate to anthroposophy in practical terms. Is it sufficient if one has some kind of profession, some mission in life? Is it sufficient if one acquires this knowledge? Or is it necessary that one pursues also that path into the spiritual worlds for oneself, the path Dr. Steiner has described? I would like to ask how we should conduct ourselves in this regard. Rudolf Steiner. Allow me to make a preliminary remark. In the last lecture that has been announced here, I will be speaking about the building in Dornach, not just in terms of the outer building, but in such a way that the lecture will surely be especially interesting for painters and sculptors, and of course also for all people in general. It is indeed an appropriate analogy to compare what we can attain in anthroposophy with climbing a mountain. We can start from many different points at the bottom, but we will still always reach the same summit. Likewise, in our development, each of us can start from a different point, and we still like to do so even if we have already started from one starting point. We have built that building in Dornach, because we wanted to put something there, something artistic, that is the expression of our anthroposophical worldview, just as the nutshell is the expression of the nut. If you have any sense for morphology, you will realize that the nut cannot have any other shell than the one it actually has. The same formative forces are contained in the shell as in the edible part of the nut itself. Now, when the anthroposophical worldview is represented in our Gertianum and Dornach, then to me the former is the actual nut, the other is only the shell. That means that we had to build out of the same impulse out of which we speak inside the building, for example. It is indeed true that one can start from any of the many, very different points. For example, we can follow up further on what Dr. Kalisko presented here today about the threefold nature of the human being. The peculiar thing here is that when you pursue that matter further, after all, as Dr. Kalisko said, in a lecture these things can only be mentioned briefly, you will see that you basically enter a condition of soul that is very different from the one you started with. The principles that are explained there are so deeply rooted in real life that in their logical progression, they not only lead people to certain conclusions, but also really work in their soul. And when we put these things that are real principles into practice, we find that real forces come alive in our soul. Ultimately, this is how we attain a vision of the human form. What at first seems to be a theory then changes all by itself into a sculptural view of the human form. And that is how we come to know and understand the human form from the inside. This is how we tried to work in the sculptures at the Gertianum and Dornach, in order to comprehend the human form from the inside. Yes, and there is still more to it. For instance, we have also tried to deal with the material. In the process, we come to realize the principles of spatial design. Thus, it is particularly interesting to discover, through working with one's hands, that when sculpting a human head, for example, when sculpting an eye, there is a great difference between one material, such as clay or marble, and another material, such as wood. That is, we understand clearly that you have to shape or scrape wood. What matters is that you work into the concave. When working with clay, however, you must work into the convex. As you sculpt or work with a solid material, you must always focus on working into the convex. In contrast, when working with soft wood, what matters is that you scrape things out of the wood. In this way, something that looked at first like a theory changes, I would say all by itself, into a certain artistic design, into an immersion in those formative forces of which we want to say they are the formative forces of nature itself. And that is the inner transition between what we have as a starting point and the point we ultimately arrive at. For example, the transition to the artistic realm. What is typical of anthroposophy is that it does not stop at a particular soul situation, but instead leads us into quite different soul situations. And in understanding the human being, we initially find the transition, starting from anatomy and physiology, which work abstractly, or at most in a sensory and illustrative way, and arriving at the human being's inner creative forces, that is, science becomes artistic vision. That transition indeed exists, and then we encounter something grand, and we can have the feeling that nature itself is an artist, not just metaphorically speaking, but in the true and real sense of the word. That is how we find our way into the artistic realm. People, the epistemologists, will say, fine, but knowledge must be gained in a logical progression. Knowledge must not operate in some eidetic way, using images as described here. Instead, knowledge must progress by conclusions. It must progress along the guided thread of logic. Well, fine. But that is only a subjective demand. If nature does not work in the way we dictate to it, then, thanks to our logic, we completely miss and fail to grasp the deeper meaning of nature. Thus, we can only get close to nature by entering in complete impartiality into this metamorphosis of the soul situation. That is one thing to keep in mind. Another thing to keep in mind is the transition to the practical realm. You see, I wrote the book entitled Toward Social Renewal, and it is indeed widely read these days. However, the understanding has not progressed very far yet. Otherwise, people would realize that the book was not written for reading. Forgive me for putting it so paradoxically. Rather, the book was written so that people would do what is set forth there, that they would do it in some way, each in his or her own way, depending on his or her situation. The book was actually written based only on observation and experience, with the focus entirely on the practical. Of course, you have to express yourself with words and sentences, but these are used only to point at what is actually meant. And that is where the transition to direct practice is. And that is what anthroposophy actually wants to be. Anthroposophy leads into all the practical areas of life just as naturally as it leads us into the realm of the artistic. It leads us into dexterity and agility, and ultimately in this way we arrive at things that some people consider quite open to question and contestation. Some people believe certain truths must be expressed differently. But as I have often said in my lectures, I cannot imagine that anyone who is a good philosopher would not also be a good chemist or a good sorter of potatoes. It is actually not possible for anyone to discourse logically on concepts and ideas without also being able to chop wood when it counts, or perhaps even when it doesn't count. I believe that if we are fully present with our whole being, when we are chopping wood or digging potatoes, for example, then we do the job perhaps more skillfully, or at least learn just as much logic as we do in logical college seminars. That may seem paradoxical to you, but nevertheless, that's how it is. And that is above all what anthroposophy wants to assert. There is something unified, something concretely and consistently unified in everything. Therefore, I want to answer your question positively by saying that when you look around among what we already have nowadays in the various fields of knowledge, you will certainly find points of contact somewhere. And starting from there, you can arrive anywhere. Anthroposophy does not want to be one-sided. It is possible to begin at the wrong end, but through what we strive for as human beings, we still eventually end up with the right things, even though initially we may have felt that none of this concerned us at all. The main thing is that the will to keep going from where we are, if starting out is to have any meaning at all. And that is where the window opens for me to come to my point. Because anthroposophy is far from any pedantry, it should be understood in such a way that one can start with it at any point, wherever one wants, and still reach a goal. For example, you could start from reflections, such as the ones provided in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, and if you go far enough along on that path, you can reach any area from there. Or you can start from a more scientific perspective, for example, one like that presented by Dr. Kalisco in his lecture earlier. And when you start there, you can still arrive at what you need. The previous speaker explains that he had something very specific in mind. He thinks it is logical that we can reach the summit from any point. He wants to take an example from the artistic community. For instance, a person could be a sculptor or a painter. Both could give rise to the deep art we already have today, for example, Expressionism and Futurism. But he found that no universal human being, such as Goethe, emerges even when we work our way into anthroposophy and live in what anthroposophists and even the genuine Rosicrucians have, namely the ascent to the level of Devakan. Now the speaker wonders whether it is necessary to follow specifically this path, to work one's way up to those realms, purely with one's soul, intellectually. or if one could also start from another philosophical direction. Rudolf Steiner. If we use the examples you have mentioned, namely expressionism, futurism, and so on, I would like to say that all of this can sometimes appear to us today as a bit childish, paradoxical, and so on. Nevertheless, I want to point out that in all of this there is an impulse. I don't want to say that it is always healthy, but rather that it is a justified impulse. And this is an impulse for a turning back from the materialistic perception of the world and toward the spiritual realm. I don't want to speak now only about the theoretical materialism, but what I mean is the materialistic feeling or perception of the world. And even starting from this perspective, through many attempts that, compared to Goethe's universal genius, may appear very one-sided, we can still find something that has a future. But it takes time, and we must allow ourselves that time. In my view, these things have a future. You see, I have to look at it in this way. An expressionist painter of today, for example, may paint a picture in such a way that you won't be able to tell whether it is a picture of a house or a tree stump or perhaps an elephant or something like that. But you see, if I may express this paradoxically, this is basically never an artistic question. To ask what the picture is supposed to represent is indeed not an artistic question. At least, it is not the first question to be asked. Rather, the question should be why we have this color on this background, and so on. And with that, we then come to questions where we see that we are dealing here with something that is, of course, not as universal as Goethe was, but that still has a future. Perhaps you'll allow me to draw your attention to the following. If I may make a personal comment, I have studied Goethe thoroughly for 40 years, and my first writing endeavor was focused on Goethe, and since then I have never left that field of study. Now, at a certain time, in quotes, Goethe problems began to interest me. Those are the problems where Goethe did not finish something, and there are actually many things he did not complete. For example, just think of his drama titled Pandora, or his verse drama titled The Natural Daughter, and also something like his drama titled Nausicaa, and so on. Clearly there are many things Goethe did not finish. Goethe had an inwardly honest nature, and not finishing something for him meant wriggling or winding his way up to a certain point at which he then had to let things stand. He could not find his way through. He could not break through. It is very interesting to see how he came to a certain point with title Pandora. What followed after that, for the most part, were only sketches. He had wanted to continue with Pandora, had wanted to carry out what we find indicated in the sketches. We can say that he could have let the poem stand and then later developed the sketches further, but that would not have worked. For if he had written it even 8 days later, it would have become something completely different. And there is no reason to say Goethe should have worked following such a sketch. He would only have changed the whole thing again. Yes, he reached a point where he could not go on, and we can well understand why this was so. It was, in fact, because Goethe had advanced greatly in the contemplation of a certain outer metamorphosis. It is indeed magnificent to see how Goethe developed this concept of metamorphosis on his Italian journey, and how he applies it to the human being. But he was not able to actually enter into the formation of the spiritual. And why was that? Why could he not advance to the point where the spiritual works on and shapes matter? This, after all, lies in the direct line of Goethe's thoughts on metamorphosis. I don't hesitate to express these things, for they are part and parcel of what I call not only my conviction, but indeed my knowledge, no matter what people may make of this. If we follow that metamorphosis thought in a straight line, it will lead us directly to the realization that the formative forces underlying the human head today are the metamorphosed formative forces of the organism, with the exception of the head, from a former earthly life. Thus we can understand the strange shape of the skull in relation to the rest of the human organism as resulting from an extensive, far-reaching metamorphosis. But Goethe was not able to break through to the spiritual realm. This is evident from the fact that he had to stop at the very point where he should have become spiritual. He was very honest. He stopped there. Just look at the second part of Title Faust. It, too, is simply not fully finished. This is really how it is. The drama is not fully finished because in the final scenes, Goethe took the Catholic concepts and terms and wedged all that in there. The drama became something magnificent in this way, but it still is something outwardly added on, grafted on. And when we compare the ending of Faust with certain other things, we'll see the effort Goethe made there, the power he exerted there, in order to finish the drama. And yet this most contestable, abstract end phase is the moment where we come to the breakthrough to the spiritual. Even though people cannot yet do it, it is in any case a beginning, and that is why we are justified in saying these things. And that is why I believe I can say that if people were honest with themselves, they would be able to do something today from the various starting points in their immediate vicinity. For example, I believe the most natural way would be for people to start from where they stand at the moment and then join together for productive purposes. People should start from whatever field they are involved in. They will then eventually come together. It is not that important if at first people don't understand each other. From a certain point on, they will understand. It is a matter, then, of watching for the right moment, and destiny surely watches for those moments. But though I have experienced much in this regard, I cannot find that these abstract contortions, please forgive me for saying this so bluntly, that these acrobatics of springing from one plane to the next are particularly promising for human beings. Really, in most cases, these acrobatics do not come from complete inner honesty. Granted, it is possible to achieve something in this way, but generally people end up becoming estranged from the world in the process. And that is something that is least needed in our times, in these current difficult times. I don't mean this at all in a frivolous sense, but this is how it is. I want to put it like this. These acrobatics from one plane to the next are so intermixed with coquetry, with so much inner untruthfulness, that I think we must strive for everyone to start from the point where he or she is standing firmly, on solid ground, and then people will also find each other. In a way, this approach has proven itself in practice. You see, some of us are artists or doctors, like, for example, Dr. Kalisco, and others are philologists, and perhaps you will hear one of them during this course, and others are mathematicians, and yet others are through and through practical people. We have practical people among us, who are simply striving to set up the most practical arrangements possible, in which the anthroposophical spirit can live. For example, Kommerzienrat, business counselor Molt, is with us today. And he, above all, has made efforts in this direction. You'll agree, I believe, that what we are dealing with today is actually a problem of the times. And that is why it is necessary that we start from the point where we are standing today and then seek understanding with others. That is indeed something that has already proven to be practical and that I consider to be promising. But in an unworldly striving to ascend to the higher worlds, I cannot see anything that is truly honest. It is indeed true that we can understand the world only if we strive for this understanding. But it is also true that those who start from some definite area of life are more certain to achieve that higher view. Above all, they will achieve it much more concretely. They can then tell us something about the higher worlds, because they will know what things look like in those worlds. It is to their benefit to have started from a definite sphere of life, but the unworldly ascent does not lead to anything really good, at least not for humanity as a whole, though it may lead to something for the individual. I am saying this based on what corresponds to evolution through time. I am most definitely not opposed to anyone pursuing higher development and capacities for suprasensory knowledge. Indeed, I've described how this should take place. But I think that in that process, people should not neglect the sphere of life in which they are placed. This is true everywhere. Another participant in the discussion. Mr. Heisler mentioned in his lecture that Dr. Steiner presumes to have had insights into the higher worlds, and that he possibly even used Goethe as proof of this. I want to say first that I have not yet read any of Steiner's writings, and I would now like to ask whether having knowledge of a deceased person, for example, whether the deceased is in agony, is that also a certain proof for the existence of God? Those who have studied Nietzsche and who have perhaps lost their faith in God for a long time might inwardly have an easier time of it if they could reclaim their faith through the way in which Dr. Steiner speaks about God. This occult issue has been taken up again by many different people, for example by Schrenk Notzing in Munich, as well as by others. Rudolf Steiner. In my lecture today, I could only hint at certain things, but I want to say the following in response to that comment. You see, we are now living in an era in which some people strive to open up a veritable chasm between knowledge and faith. Some of them consider only those sciences healthy that deal with the purely factual, with registering, systematizing, establishing laws, that is, the purely factual. In contrast, others in the sphere of religion believe they must demand faith to uphold their sphere. Still, all this is just a characteristic of a temporary era. Just as in earlier ages, people subdivided the soul into many different soul forces, so people in our time split it into a sphere of knowing and another one of faith. But when our soul is totally honest with itself, it cannot really bear this split. We'll understand what we're dealing with here when we see the reason for this split. You see, these days, you can still talk with many people about life after death, or about divine cosmology, if you are talking on the basis of faith. That is, you can do so as long as you are not appealing in any way, and this sort of appeal is found least of all in religions, to those inner powers of persuasion that lead to proof. By talking about life after death, you naturally appeal to people's wishes, their feelings of fear, and so on. Things are very different when you talk about what I spoke about today, namely about pre-existence, about human life, our soul spiritual life before birth, or, let's say, before conception. This is what anthroposophy talks about most extensively. In anthroposophy, we focus more on prenatal life, that is, on human life before conception, on pre-existing life, from which follows, as a matter of course, life after death. We focus more on this life before birth because human egotism is less involved there. It is not a matter of indifference to people whether they go on living after death or not, but out of their egotism, they are less interested in whether they have already lived before they came to life on earth. Of course, once we open the sources of knowledge about that life on the other side of birth, the life we lived before we came into earthly life, then the other life, the one after death, follows logically. When you read my writings, you will find this described in detail. Indeed, in anthroposophy, we consider the reality of this life before birth as more or less a matter of course. But at the same time, something else emerges. Based on a certain belief, we can talk about the life after death. But as I said, this plays to people's egotism and is based on egotistical knowledge. When you talk to people about their pre-existent life, they will be led at the same time on the path of knowledge into the spiritual suprasensory world. And that is why turning our attention to the pre-existent life overcomes the chasm between faith and knowledge, the chasm that is so damaging to the human soul. You see, ancient worldviews indeed give us a certain instinctive knowledge of these things, one which we can no longer strive for. Instead, we must strive for conscious knowledge. I have to emphasize again and again that anthroposophy concerns itself intensively with our pre-existent life and even talks of repeated lives on earth. And when Lessing, in his treatise titled The Education of the Human Race, took up the idea of repeated earthly lives, he asked, though this idea of repeated lives on earth emerged in the earliest times of history, is it for this reason any less valuable? Is it less valuable just because it appeared in the most ancient times before it was corrupted by all kinds of schools? You see, the literary researchers and the like of our time take this, let's say, aesthetically. They do not hold this idea in high regard and do not want to see it as a reality. And so they say that Lessing was a great writer, but that his Education of the Human Race is clearly a work of his declining years. Lessing was indeed a great man, and when we read between the lines, we find that he has always held to the idea of repeated lives on earth. It is true, we develop knowledge of the suprasensory world, and also concrete knowledge of the spiritual realm, of the spiritual leadership of the world in general, by concerning ourselves with the life before birth, and not just with the life after death. But this fact has gradually been completely lost in recent times, and we can see this clearly in an external phenomenon I will point out to you. You see, we have the word immortal, and with the proper preparation, we speak of immortality. We have the term immortality, but we do not have a word unbornness or unbornity. For just as truly as we live on after death and are immortal, so also are we truly unborn. We need to have a separate term for this unbornness that is just as common as the term immortality. But we do not have such a word. For in our civilization, people have completely turned away from understanding immortality. And it will only be understood again if we can look at being unborn in the same way we consider being immortal. For just as at one pole of life the soul at death is released into the spiritual world, so at the other pole, namely birth, or rather conception, the soul comes again into the physical world. And just as the soul does not die, so it also is not born. Belief only becomes actual knowledge when we come to see this pre-existent life. That is how we make progress. Our suprasensory life must concern itself with pre-existence, and thus lead us on to the path that really brings us to our goal. Regarding the comment that anthroposophy is allegedly presumptuous, well, that depends on how one sees things, doesn't it? For example, until 1827, the Catholic Church considered it highly inappropriate to admit that there once was a man called Copernicus, who said that the earth moves around the sun. In other words, it was not until 1827 that Catholics were allowed to believe that. Today, the mainstream sciences have not yet given us permission to believe in repeated earthly lives, just as back then, people were not allowed to believe in the earth's movement around the sun. Of course, we can bide our time and wait until these people permit us to believe and hold to those things that are given to us in particular through anthroposophy. Until then, we have to bear the allegation of presumptuousness. That's just the way of the world. Question: what does anthroposophy stand on vaccinations against epidemics? Rudolf Steiner. In terms of content, this question does not fit really well with what was said earlier, but I will try to comment on it anyway. After all, this is how it is. We must, of course, as has already been said, by no means believe that anthroposophy disparages the successes that have been achieved in modern natural sciences and in medicine. There are many cases proving that the success that was to be achieved by means of vaccination, for example by means of smallpox vaccination, has indeed been achieved. It is a fact that the number of cases of infectious diseases has been greatly reduced thanks to more or less necessary external measures, such as hygiene, as well as through vaccinations. But many vaccinations have not been what we could call successful against other diseases. Still, we have to admit the overall efficacy of the principle of vaccination. On the other hand, this question is also something that could be looked at more in terms of psychology. There are many opponents to vaccination these days. These opponents to immunization are generally parties not psychologically accessible by means of a rational approach. These are people who act out of an inner resistance against the way medicine tries to be effective here. Based on their knowledge, they cannot say that immunization methods are ineffective because there are indeed proven effects. And those who fight against vaccinations fight out of a certain unconscious motivation against these immunization methods. Anthroposophy, however, must start from deeper, much more profound considerations. When we think of the nature of illness in connection with what has been presented to you here today, especially regarding repeated earthly lives, and when we are convinced that we have repeated lives on earth, then we also have to connect the illnesses people undergo in the present life with what they have experienced in a previous life on earth. Once we have grasped this, once we are willing to realize this, regardless of what epidemiology is saying about infectious diseases, then we have to understand that there is a certain connection between what people have undergone in an earlier earthly life and what is happening now when those same people are exposed to a certain infection. We usually say that something happens by chance. People do not want to admit that out of their subconscious they are driven to where they then come into contact with an infectious disease. Aside from what people can experience because of this, we can still come to many other views of all that is connected with the disease. For one thing, we realize that certain illnesses have something to do with the peculiarities of a particular human soul, that the illnesses are, in a certain sense, an overcoming or conquest of what that person could not achieve in a previous life. That is, the physical processes of the illness that must be endured are a compensation, a balancing, after all. The illness also comes with soul or psychological symptoms. Then we can also understand why some people, out of unconscious instinctive motivations, resist this panacea. Unconsciously, their argument is that as far as the illness is concerned, healing of the external symptoms should be paralleled by an inner further development of the soul toward the spiritual. And even if the vaccination used makes it possible for things to work out just as intended, we would still have to say that even if through the appropriate measures all epidemics were extinguished and the number of illnesses reduced, the question is nevertheless whether something else is not also necessary that in a way must come to meet this process. Namely, that an inner development of the soul toward the spiritual must take place at the same time. People would have to understand that such a method is possible. We can acknowledge and respect everything the sciences say, but we must be clear about the necessity that in addition to the external healing methods we have, there must be something else that moves the soul forward on its inner path and points to earlier spiritual connections, to earlier lives. Anthroposophy will never say anything against what the natural sciences bring us. Question: how can we develop an imagination? Where can we find its content if we are not to link it to a sensory conception or a memory? Rudolf Steiner: that is based on a misunderstanding. I said that what is to be used to meditate and what then leads to imagination, should be clear and easily understandable. It should be straightforward and be manageable, so that no reminiscences come up, and so our subconscious does not get involved in the relevant process of the soul. You see, if you recall a past experience and then meditate, you will find that many elements you have more or less disregarded are living in the image of such an experience. These elements emerge from the subconscious, and as a result you no longer move fully in what you intended. What matters is whether it is all under control and manageable. For example, you can meditate by calling up before your soul a circle with a triangle inscribed in it. What matters is that your soul does the exercises with something it can manage, something that is straightforward and easy to comprehend. You can also meditate on something qualitative. If we let such straightforward, understandable things rest in our soul in order to meditate on them, then we do not run the risk of having reminiscences rise up from our subconscious. The point is not that we should not use something plausible to our senses, or some recollection or reminiscence for our meditation. Indeed, we can use either, but only as long as it remains understandable and straightforward. We should not use anything that then evokes all kinds of conscious or unconscious processes. What matters is the straightforwardness, not whether we imagine this or that arbitrary thing that could represent or mean anything. For example, if you meditate on the concept, in quotes, city, you have experienced so much in life, have so many associations with the concept city, that you cannot easily know beforehand what will emerge in your meditation. Another example has also been reported in the relevant literature. A nature researcher crosses the street in a city and comes to stand in front of a shop window. He stands there and gazes into the shop window, and there sees the title page of a treatise on earthworms, a subject that surely must be of interest to him, no? But while he stands there gazing and sees the book on the anatomy of earthworms, he suddenly has to smile. A naturalist who suddenly smiles while looking at a book on earthworms. He himself finds it very unlikely that he should be smiling at this moment, and he wants to know how that happened. He turns away, completely away, closes his eyes, and then tries, in the dark, to understand why he was smiling. And, lo and behold, he hears the sounds of a barrel organ in the far distance. He had completely ignored the sound earlier, both unconsciously as he was walking along, and even consciously and deliberately when he was looking at the book. But the sounds have nevertheless reached his ears, lived in a way within him, and brought a smile to his lips, albeit an unconscious one. So now he hears the barrel organ and finds it plays the same melody to which he had learned to dance 30 years ago. Since then he had never thought again of that important event, of having learned to dance to this melody. Still, that event continued to live in his soul, in such a way that now he had to smile, even as the researcher of nature that he now is. You see, there is much that lies in our subconscious, and I could tell you that there are mystics who hear angels, and this can indeed be true and real, but for many a mystic who thinks he hears something in the world of angels, what is actually happening, because these things remain in the subconscious, not only as reminiscence, but also undergo metamorphoses, is that the supposed angel voices are metamorphosed sounds of a barrel organ. Indeed, many things that seem to us significant revelations are actually only metamorphosed sounds of a barrel organ. This is what we must know above all. The anthroposophical method is an absolutely safe and certain method. The more we ascend into the spiritual world, the more will we fight off anything that, arising from the things themselves, can mislead and confuse us. Thus, it is not a matter of meditating on things that are not straightforward or understandable, and that we cannot manage. What matters is that we meditate on things that have been put together for us by someone who understands these things, or that we ourselves have chosen a content we can manage or control. What matters is how we look at a triangle, for example, of which we know that it has three sides and three angles, the sum of which is 180 degrees. We can contemplate this without much of anything emerging from our subconscious. This is how straightforward and clear our meditations must be, so that we avoid descending from what we have willingly chosen into the involuntary and automatic, into the unconscious. We want to avoid something coming up that is merely memory, or that was at one time a sensory perception, as in our example of the faraway sounds of a barrel organ. Instead, what has to be present in our consciousness must be something that is as straightforward and as readily comprehensible as a mathematical concept. That is, what we can use to practice imaginative cognition. Of course, we have to think in a materialistic way of everything that arises out of our memory. What matters is not so much that it has developed out of memory, but more that whatever we meditate on must be readily comprehensible. A participant in the discussion. Dr. Kalisco mentioned something today that greatly interests me. When he spoke of the three centers, he said, in a way, that the head consumes everything that rises up as vital life force from the lower organs. That is, the organs in our lower body always produce something living, something that the head then, so to speak, devours. I would like to know how Anthroposophy thinks of the actual physical body. In talking about Nietzsche, Dr. Steiner mentioned today that the physical body broke Nietzsche's soul. That is, his soul was not strong enough to overcome the body. From a general standpoint, without having the physical body, I have heard about this from one direction. I have learned about the method of Dr. Hanisch. What use is it for me if I attain knowledge of higher worlds and have a toothache? If I cannot help myself when I have a toothache, what good is it to me, then, to know something of the spiritual world? Should we approach mastery over the physical body from the material or from the spiritual direction? Eugen Kalisco. First of all, we have to be clear about the nature of the human being, because only then can we understand what human health and sickness really consist of. When you ask what good it is for you to know something of the overall world context while you still have a toothache and are prone to all kinds of other illnesses, well, then we have to say that this is a very one-sided way to look at this. We can apply to this view what we have talked about earlier, namely that human egotism is present in great measure when people say they do not want anything to do with the spiritual realm because such knowledge does not free them from their toothache. Knowledge is something that we have to experience, that drives us not to let go, something we have to continue with even while overcoming a toothache. Therefore, such a point of view that is completely saturated with a kind of materialistic, egotistic striving, even when talking about supersensory worlds, cannot really be recognized or accepted. But what is important is that we first of all grasp the nature of the human being in order to get beyond the materialistic conceptions about how to care for the body. We cannot take care of our body and we cannot work therapeutically if we do not have any insights into the interconnections of forces that make up the nature of the human body. Rudolf Steiner. I would like to add a few comments to this and illustrate them with examples. You probably know the widely used saying that there are countless illnesses, but only one health. I think there is nothing more wrong than this saying. Indeed, there are countless illnesses, but there are also countless healths. Each person, however healthy, has his or her own health, and such blustering is not acceptable under any circumstances. It is indeed correct to say, even from the most spiritual standpoint, that human beings must in every way look after the health of their organism. I myself, as a result of my research, have come to the point of looking at the life of the imagination, for example, in such a way that I consider it a radical error to believe that the activity of the brain as such can in any way be the basis for the activity of the spirit. The way I see it, this is an error I would like to characterize in more detail with the following example. Let us assume that there is a street that is all soggy and sodden from rain. People have walked on this street, and their footsteps left marks in the softened road surface. And then someone says that this road is configured in a certain way, as you can see in the various lines, tracks, and so on. All of this must have been caused by forces that come up from below. It is all caused by something that is down there, inside the earth. When you hear this, you will, of course, readily reply that this is nonsense. The tracks have been embedded in the road from the outside and not from below. Likewise, spiritual science naturally leads me to see the brain configuration and the configurations of the nerves, which have been shown to us by physiologists, as indeed truly existing. But those configurations have been engraved there by the life of the soul and spirit, which leave their imprint in the brain. But at the same time, it is a matter of then understanding that this entire bodily existence, between birth and death, is the solid ground on which consciousness develops, that it is, for that development, a solid substrate, offering a sort of resistance or counter-support. Otherwise, we could not develop the life of the imagination. In order to be able to reflect back, the imagination needs that substrate. A mirror needs a backing board. Clearly, then, even from the most spiritual standpoint, it is important to keep our physical organization as healthy as possible. And here it is a question of developing true views of what a healthy physical constitution really is. And only this is what we mean when we have attained a more comprehensive way of looking at this through spiritual science. I want to give you a few examples for this, not to show off, but just to indicate what the foundation is for my view of life, which I developed based on spiritual knowledge. About 36 years ago, I was recommended to a family as a private teacher for a young boy. Among the four sons in that family, there was one, back then about 11 years old, who in everyone's view was especially unfortunate, also in the family's prejudiced view. The family was unhappy about the boy because at the age of 11, when he had to take an exam in school, he could produce nothing but a great hole in the paper from using his eraser so much. And that's what this 11-year-old boy's knowledge in all school subjects was like. His mother was deeply unhappy. His father was somewhat skeptical and wary. The family doctor, who was one of the most excellent practical doctors I have ever met, he was indeed a great man, had already given up on the boy. Well, I was hired to teach the other three boys in the family. I observed the 11-year-old and then told his mother, the only one in the whole family, who out of her motherly heart still had some understanding for the boy, that although I could not promise anything, I would like to use all my skills, to the extent I had any, to make something of him. The other family members said the doctor had already given up on the boy, and they looked at me as though they were not sure I could be entrusted with the education of the other three boys after all, now that they had heard my view of the fourth boy. But the boy's mother prevailed. It really took some doing and persevering on her part before the boy was then given into my care. I had told them that I would have to have absolutely free rein to do as I saw fit. The boy suffered from very severe hydrocephalus. He was really in poor shape. Now, I basically applied only spiritual hygiene in a methodical way. In fact, I applied only what I would like to call economy in teaching concepts, skills, and so on. I stipulated that the boy should be allowed to listen to as much piano music as I determined, that he was allowed to have other things to the extent I decided. Indeed, I can say that sometimes I studied for 3 hours to prepare to work for 15 minutes with the boy. and it is through such a spiritual and pedagogical hygiene that after 2 years, the boy was able to transition to the gymnasium, high school. His head had actually become smaller. Now, you may say that his condition might have improved on its own anyway. But really, that is not the point. The point is not that he might have improved on his own. The boy really had a severe case of hydrocephalus, and in all the years before, his head just would not get smaller. Even if he had survived for those 2 years, despite the hydrocephalus, without the intervention, he would certainly not have been able to go to high school after those 2 years, especially considering the results that had been achieved with him up to that point. The important thing really was that through 2 years of intensive work, specifically such individual care with hygienic, attentive care for the boy's organism that was in total disarray and had to be treated, the boy was brought to that level of achievement. This is not a matter of general rules, even though some may be quite correct, but of intimate knowledge of the nature of the human being as such. Regarding the claim that only a healthy body can be the expression of a healthy soul, now, if we were to translate this claim into real life, it would not be true at all. Here's another example. A renowned physician came to me one day and told me about a case he was treating that interested him very much. He said a patient had consulted him who had had a fall quite some time ago. In that fall, he had broken his nasal bone, and as a result, his nose was somewhat crooked. This doctor wanted to operate on the patient, but first wanted to talk about this with me. After all, with a certain deeper insight into the nature of the human being, one does see things differently than people necessarily see them who look at health only from the outside. All I could say to that doctor was to advise him not to operate, for here is a rare stroke of luck. The man now gets just the amount of air that his lungs can tolerate. His nasal passages now have just the right width he needs for his special case, for his constitution. And this must be left as it is for him. After all, the man obviously was basically doing well with the slightly crooked nose. There are many other examples I could list here, but the general principle is entirely correct. We must work toward health for our body, but we must do so in quite different ways, in individual cases. This may seem strange, but I have often noticed this among naturopaths. They will often claim that this or that individual has something, for example, that there is something irregular in the movement of the person's heart and that this must be treated and cured. But if we look more closely, we often have to say in such cases, leave it alone. Let the man have his heart abnormality. That may be just right for him. And if you try to cure him of this, he will surely get all the sicker. Because people have a certain pattern or template in mind, much that is unnecessary is done in this way. We often see that people use general methods that are not much different, at least not as far as the logic of the matter, the logic of facts, is concerned, than those applied in the case of a woman who was a faith healer. That was awful. She said all kinds of things that people were supposed to imagine and believe in order to become strong and healthy. She said people would become hardy and toughened up that way. But I have never met anyone who looked so pitiful and miserable as that faith healer, despite the fact that she always took great care that not even the slightest breeze would touch her, because the least bit of a draft caused her the most horrible symptoms, she said. You see, these are things that we should look at as they really are, and not just based on a certain predefined notion, a template, let's say. It is entirely true, on the one hand, that we must work toward physical health as much as possible. But insight into what health really is must come from spiritual knowledge. That is, we not only have to look after our own health ourselves, but even more importantly, we also must be aware that we are a part of the cosmos. As you know, the air that is now inside us was out there in the cosmos just a short time ago. And this applies to everything else also. We as human beings must look at the world from the perspective of what we are, a part of the cosmos. Of course, these general things can only be interpreted in this way, and I just wanted to point out a few things with these explanations. Jakob Hugentobler thanks the audience and lectures and closes the meeting. The end of lecture/discussion 5.